WYCITR 101.9, Vancouver.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. Today's Remembrance Day. 90 years ago to this day, the Great War ended. Approximately 66,000 Canadian soldiers died in the line of duty. Remembrance Day is a day to honor their incredible sacrifices. But it is also a day for us to remember our Canadian soldiers who have died in the last 90 years in the Second World War, the Korean War, in the countless peacekeeping missions around the world, and most recently in Afghanistan. 97 soldiers have died in Afghanistan since 2002. It is a figure we are not used to hearing. In the last 50 years, over 100,000 of our soldiers were based in UN peacekeeping missions around the world. 110 of them lost their lives. But what we have learned in 90 years is that Remembrance Day is more than just a day to remember those who have died for our service. It is also a day to remember those who are still living, veterans of war who live amongst us, many of whom live with injuries, physical and emotional, sometimes visible and more often invisible. The announcement of a soldier wounded on duty in Afghanistan is painfully felt by so many of us. We are reminded, often too quickly, that even today our soldiers are fighting in a dangerous war. This is Prof Talk, the Remembrance Day edition, radio that reminds us about peace in the world, lest we forget. My first guest is Professor Marvin Westwood. Dr. Westwood is a professor in the Department of Educational and Counseling Psychology and Special Education at UBC. In March 2008, he was awarded the Royal Canadian Legion's Highest Service Merit Award for the development of the Canadian Military and Veterans Transition Program. This is the highest recognition award given to a non-military person. He has published an article this week in UBC Reports titled, Lest We Forget, Those Who Do Return. I reached him at his office in the education faculty. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Professor Westwood, for more than a decade, you have been working with veterans returning from war and peacekeeping missions around the world. Can you tell us about your work with them?
I can, indeed. I am currently working with what we call the modern-day soldiers, or that is soldiers who are deployed back to Canada from overseas assignments, that it would be Bosnia or former Yugoslavia, could be Afghanistan, and so on. But this work got started because of my earlier work about 10 years ago with the World War II veterans, who in my work with them in their life review project encouraged me and urged me to make sure that we do this kind of reintegration program much earlier for soldiers, that people should not have to wait as they did, some of them, for 50 to 60 years.
And so can you tell us some specifics about the program?
Yeah, the specifics about the program, the best way to describe it is that, as you know, many soldiers serving overseas are exposed to war-related traumas, and these are called invisible wounds when they come back. They are, in fact, traumatized. They're invisible because people can't see any sign of a physical change. But these particular injuries, they're sometimes in extreme cases called PTSD, but not necessarily PTSD. They can be just a war-related trauma. It affects their personal life, their career life, and their just general health. And what our program attempts to do is bring soldiers together with professionals helping them, be able to first tell their stories what happened, to be able to share stories, because soldiers only want to talk to other soldiers because they believe that only soldiers understand soldiers. In the process of storytelling, they usually identify what they would describe as critical incidents of trauma exposure that they can't quite come to terms with. So then we go, the next part of our program is to help them with a process called kind of structured enactments to recover and to re-experience and in a safe, kind of supportive environment, kind of the event of the trauma to reduce their symptoms, and that seems to be highly effective.
Now, what do we know now about PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, than what we might have not known before?
Well, what we know now is trauma-related injuries go into the body, and they can't really be talked out of us. The injuries are not conscious many times, and so the recovery from trauma is very, very difficult because often the soldier, him or herself, doesn't really know what's happened. They can't figure it out. They just all of a sudden become, nightmares may begin, or they get a startled response. They have intrusive thoughts. They find themselves engaged in hyperarousal, mood swings, depression in some cases, suicide.
Now, is your program something that a soldier would volunteer to do? How would they find out about your program?
Yes, it is totally volunteer. Two things: it's volunteer and it's paid for by the Royal Canadian Legion. So soldiers are usually referred to the program by other soldiers who've been through our program. We've had over 160 who've been through our program. They tend to trust other soldiers who refer them rather than any healthcare providers. There's a great stigma about seeking help for soldiers, that you can understand. So they tend to be very avoidant about going to counselors and psychologists because they feel it's career suicide for them.
And how long would a program be?
The program runs equivalent to about 6 full days. It can be offered over 3 weekends, or can be offered over 2 to 3 day sessions, or we're proposing to do one coming up in the new year, which would be 6 full days. And they're always residential. They're day long. The soldiers stay right in the training site, and they spend a lot of time after the program's over talking and catching up. And there are a lot of bonding and group connection forms, and that's also very helpful and very therapeutic for them.
Now, what do you believe these soldiers are gaining from your program? What have their reactions been?
Well, their reactions have been, they actually tell us, because we do evaluations, they report that their self-esteem and self-confidence has increased. The nightmares and intrusive dreams, in many cases, have stopped. They understand the knowledge. They acquire a knowledge of what trauma is and how that it cannot be controlled just by thinking differently. It's really an injury to the body. They report, in most cases, having improved social relationships with their partners, their families, and their kids. And many of them actually are able to, when the trauma repair is more complete, they're able to actually look at other career options and make different career choices.
Why do you believe their stories are so important? Why do you believe that it's so important for Canada to make their reentry into civilian life easier?
Oh, I'm committed to the program, both as I am a counseling psychologist, as I feel there's an ethical responsibility, because we have the professional expertise to help people, so I should respond that way. But more importantly, I think there's a moral question here, that if we send people overseas to do work on behalf of the country, and we know that they will sustain significant, up to 30% of them will sustain negative and debilitating traumatic injuries, that we have a social responsibility to provide sort of after service care for these people and to help them become fully functioning people again as they were before they left and are contributing productive members of society. It's absolutely our ethical and moral responsibility as a society, given what we know of the costs of serving overseas. We didn't know that before, but now we do. There's no excuse not to.
And you've also said that peacekeepers as well suffers some of the same debilitating effects as combat soldiers.
That's correct.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, that's a good distinction. Peacekeepers are actually, they suffer some of the most significant traumatic wounds. Why? Because they are not armed and they cannot return fire, and their rules of engagement are different. So they basically see themselves as sitting targets, and so their stress levels are often much higher than the combat soldiers, because they can't defend themselves unless they are fired upon. So they feel a greater vulnerability, and therefore they're more open and receptive to the kind of stress that comes from the unknown.
Now, there's a personal connection to all of to the work that you're doing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in the personal connection of this work, which started it, it was over 10 years ago, one of my family members, his name was Jack Simpson, had he actually was the father-in-law of my brother, and he was known in the family as somebody who was very quiet and basically alcoholic. He had served in the Second World War, and when he'd come home, he'd been quite altered and changed. Near the end of his life, I felt fortunate. I had a conversation with him, and we were alone in my living room, and his daughter and family was all in the other room. And I was just asking him about his experience and how his experience in the Second World War was. And he told me that he became very distressed. He hadn't told anyone before, and he's finally felt confident. He said, well, he had killed somebody. I said, well, that is what soldiers are trained to do, is it not? And he said, but you don't understand. He said, I had to kill him by hand, and that has haunted me forever.
Wow.
So as a result, when he came back, he's just a young man, probably 21 or 22, he came with that memory that haunted him. And then to medicate, he began drinking and then became subsequently alcoholic. Once he told me this story, he felt very free, and he released a lot of his emotions there in the living room. The family noticed that they'd never seen their father cry before. And so I explained with his permission about what had happened. And once they knew what had happened, they saw him very differently. In fact, he was seen as quite heroic. But before that, I think they saw him in a rather negative or certainly not a dignified manner. And now his position in the family, he has subsequently died, of course, but mm-hmm. he's thought of as somebody very important and with a lot of compassion and understanding and the need to have such programs earlier.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. What does Remembrance Day mean for you then?
Remembrance Day for me is different than most Canadians, I think. The article in the University Reports summarizes it this way. When I'm Remembrance Day now, I actually don't think of those who've lost their lives as much. I don't really know them, but I think I changed the title. The change of title for me is Lest We Forget Those Who Do Return. I kind of honor the service of people and think about those who have returned and actually some of the costs and the suffering that they do bring back. And the resolve to keep this program going, hope other people get involved so we can help these people engage in the trauma repair that they need to be healthy again.
Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace that brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see.
You have just heard the voice of Camille Johnson. She is a UBC alumnus who has also recently graduated from the Canadian College of Performing Arts in Victoria. She will be performing in a holiday show titled Panto of the Rings at the Presentation House in North Vancouver from December 19th to January 10th. Tickets can be purchased online at www.phtheatre.org. My next guest is Professor Cheryl Grace from the UBC Department of English, whose recent research has focused on war, the arts, and the Canadian North. Dr. Grace was recently awarded the Killam Prize, Canada's most distinguished annual award for outstanding academic achievement. She's one of the key organizers at this year's annual Royal Society of Canada Symposium, put on by the Academy of Arts and Humanities, which will be held this Friday, November the 14th in Ottawa. The title of the symposium is The Cultures of War and Peace. Professor Grace, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Why is it important to have the theme of war and peace at this year's symposium?
Well, that's a very, very good question. There were three topics that were put forward, and the fellows in Academy One were canvassed as to which ones they would like. And by far, the overwhelming response came back from colleagues and fellows that it was the war and peace topic that they wanted. The other two topics happen to be autobiography and biography, and then the North, because this is the last part of the International Polar Year. So something on the North was important, and the North has been very dear to me in my research. But it was clear that people across the country, fellows in Academy One, found this subject of war and peace the one they wanted to see addressed. And then in a larger discussion with the other two academies, sort of banding back and forth how we would do this, I think there was general agreement that this was a topic that was timely, possibly urgent, but certainly timely because of the wars of the 20th century, but also the wars that continue to go on in the world right now, and indeed that Canadian armed forces are involved in various capacities, peacekeeping and so forth. And it was also extremely important to me and to the organizing committee to find a subject that would be resonant for young people. And of the three subjects that we had in mind or proposed, it seemed to us that war and peace was an issue of particular interest. It's interesting to everybody. Anybody would be concerned, but that younger people would be especially interested. And I'm delighted to be able to tell you that we have students coming from across the country, and this is the first time that the Royal Society has ever opened its symposium to students. And they are coming from the Maritimes, from the Ontario area, from BC, from Alberta. They've been sponsored by private donors. Some of the donors, I sent you the program, you can see some of them listed. And UBC is certainly helping to send some students. So this is going to be quite something. They will be there as observers, listening to the talks, writing reports afterwards when they get back to their home universities. And in some instances, they're actually doing graduate research themselves on the subject of war and the representation of war. So I'm very thrilled. I was told earlier today we've got over 300 registrants, which is, again, very large, and a goodly number. I would say probably at least 100 of those people are going to be young people. And, you know, the people that I have devoted my career to, students. And from across the country. I think it's an absolutely amazing phenomenon. And it seems to have corroborated our view that in choosing this subject, we would be choosing a subject that spoke to younger generation.
Can you give us a sneak preview of some of the issues that will be explored at the symposium, or even some of the speakers you have lined up?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And I think to begin, one needs to have the complete title of the symposium. It's called The Cultures of War and Peace. And each of those three words, I think, the culture, war, and peace, is extremely important. So, for instance, we have speakers who will talk about the role of Canadians in World War One or World War Two, or speakers who will talk about the peace movement or certain aspects of the peace movement. We have other speakers who are addressing conflict management in very, very difficult parts of the world, and models for reaching consensus or peaceful resolutions of deeply rooted conflicts. So we have historians, we have literary scholars, we have art historians. Laura Brandon from the War Museum will be speaking about the war paintings by women and the role of women in representing the Great War, World War One and World War Two, and possibly even in contemporary situations in Afghanistan. So we will be looking at, you know, cultural issues, conflict management or ways of resolving conflict, the history of war, participation in war, and then various attempts at peace movements. And so all three of those key words. Now, I'm excited about all the speakers who are coming. They are quite a range of speakers, from very senior and very distinguished to much younger scholars. Some of them are fellows of the Royal Society, and many of them are not. And that's, again, something I wanted to make very visible and present. I guess, in some senses, the most exciting of our two keynote speakers is Romeo Dallaire, simply because of his gifts, his dedication of his life since Rwanda. And, of course, he's also a very, very fine speaker. He will be giving the first of the keynote talks, and that will start the day off. And then at the beginning of the afternoon, we have one of our younger and leading historians, Jonathan Vance from Western, University of Western Ontario. Jonathan's written a couple of really wonderful books, and he's going to be talking about Canadian poets who ended up as soldiers in World War II and why they went and how it changed them and their sort of ethics or the sense of morality of their contributions in war. And then, as I say, we have a whole Laura Brandon from the War Museum. We have people from the States. Mary Louise Pratt is coming to talk about the current rhetoric of war in the United States. Frances Early from the Maritimes will be talking about peace movement. A colleague of mine from Guelph in theater studies at Guelph will be talking about the what he calls war play, and the sort of obsession with reenactment rituals in which boys dress up or men dress up and reenact battles. And he's obviously troubled or worried about that. Roland Paris from the University of Ottawa will be talking about conflict management and the search for peace and public policy. And again, he'll be focusing on the Afghan mission, but, you know, he's published widely on those particular issues. And then we have, as I say, Anne Wheeler, one of Canada's preeminent filmmakers, has created three major films about war and is working on a new one. She's going to give a major talk and show clips from some of her films. I'm extremely excited about having Vern Thiessen present. Vern Thiessen is a Canadian playwright, Governor General's award-winning playwright. And he will be reading from his new play, his 2008 play called Vimy. And the Battle of Vimy Ridge in 1917 in the Great War is one of those watershed moments for national identity for Canada. It's the battle in which we've been told Canada came of age and so on. And he's written this extremely powerful play about Vimy and about that whole question of national identity. And then you may have heard of the other writer who will be coming, Joseph Boyden, a very young novelist who's written that famous book, Three Day Road, about First Nations soldiers in the Great War. and Joseph Boyden will be reading from Three Day Road. But that's still leaving me not telling you about the final event of the day, which is something truly unique. And we have a Canadian composer. Her name is Janet Danielson. And she has composed an original quartet. And the premiere of this quartet will take place at the end of the day, end of a long and challenging day on Friday the 14th of November. And her quartet is being performed by four young musicians from the School of Music at the University of Ottawa. And they will be playing the premiere of this new piece of music, which is inspired by a poem written by a soldier, a Canadian soldier in World War II. And he was killed a week after he wrote that poem. So it's going to be a very moving way to end our day. But as you can see, we move from social policy and a very distinguished and famous speaker like Senator Dallaire, through the arts, through some of our young famous writers, to something completely unique with students performing a premiere. So it's going to be quite a day.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Can you also tell us a little bit about what you will be speaking or addressing at the symposium?
Yes.
Or even your current research on Canadian representations of war?
Well, I can. And in fact, the brief presentation I'll be giving focuses on World War II and its impact on the Canadian North, coming back to a longstanding interest of mine and research subject for me, which is the North. But Vancouver playwright Marie Clements, also Governor General award-winning playwright, published a play, and it was premiered here in Vancouver in 2003, called Burning Vision. And it is about, I suppose I could say it's about, the mining of uranium up in the Northwest Territories and Great Bear Lake before, during, and after World War II. And many people have said that the uranium that was mined at that mine site, at Port Radium, as it was called, ended up in the Manhattan Project, which produced the bombs that were dropped on Japan towards the very end of World War II in the Pacific. And in this play about the Dene men who mined the ore, Marie Clements explores that whole question of mining uranium, the cancer rates of the Dene population in the area from the mine and from the mine tailings and from the radiation that polluted the whole environment. And she's really telling a story of an unknown episode in Canadian history, particularly Canadian history as it affects World War II and affects the North in Canada. And it's a very, very powerful play. A very allegorical, symbolic play, and I'm going to focus right in on that play because everybody has to speak briefly, and I saw the premiere, and I'll be able to say a little bit about that and the impact of war in Canada's North. Now, that leads in terms of my own research, Farah, to my own research on the militarization of the North right now with climate change, and different circumpolar countries competing over who gets to control the Northwest Passage and the resources that lie under the polar ice cap as it melts and the Beaufort Sea. So that's just a brief look at where I'm going with the future of my own research.
Well, it's been wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. Congratulations on getting this initiative going.
Great. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Prof Talk on UBC's CITR 101.9 FM on the Point Grey campus in Vancouver. You were just listening to an interview with English professor Cheryl Grace. She will also be presenting at the Canada and Theatres of War Symposium, which will bring together major Canadian theatre and film artists, along with award-winning scholars and historians, to examine the dramas of Canada at war in lectures, panels, films, and theatrical presentations. The symposium is put on by the UBC Department of Theatre and Film. It will be held at the Frederick Wood Theatre next week from November 18th to the 19th. Admission is free, and full information can be found on the department's website at www.theater.ubc.ca. Stay tuned now for Wiener's Barbecue with host Daryl Wiener. We would love to hear your comments and feedback. Please email us at proftalk@gmail.com or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of the show anytime on citr.ca. I'm Farah Khan. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Zipcar gets it. You live your life 4 months at a time. Commitment freaks you out. Your most expensive asset is your laptop, and even that's portable. Why own a car when you can have a Mini for cruising with friends, a roomy Yaris for moving your affordable Swedish furniture into your dorm room, and a Ford Escape for when you take a break from homework to hit the North Shore slopes?
UBC students get a sweet discount on Zipcar membership, $30 for the year. You can reserve by the hour or day, and gas, insurance, and 150 kilometers per day are always included. Your first step is to put down that slice of pizza and sign up at zipcar.com/UBC. After that, just head to one of the locations on campus to pick up your car, and the rest is up to you.